Are we on? Okay. Our topic for debate today is biodiversity. Should we prevent species from becoming extinct or not? And at what cost? My name's Kathy, and my team, the Tree Huggers, is arguing in favor of prevention of species from becoming extinct. My teammates are Becky, Victoria, and Mia. I'll begin by introducing our positions and our background on the topic, and then our opponents, the Darwinners, will then introduce their position and background. For each of the three main points, my teammates will expand on our arguments with rebuttals following, then the other team will give their opposing arguments with our rebuttals. Okay, tree huggers, here we go. As I was driving my big gas guzzling SUV around town today, and went to pick up an antibiotic prescription for my son, I was just wondering how much my everyday actions are related to that buzzword of biodiversity. Biodiversity, the word literally means difference of variety of living things on Earth. Lots of different things. So we say we all want to save habitats and save animals and keep nice, pristine places wild to go for a hike, but is it really worth saving species from becoming extinct? Who cares? I mean, who really cares? And would we be very much affected by the disappearance of the spotted owl or cone snails or a tree with peely bark that's worthless to the lumber industry or a slimy slug? I mean, really, especially when we need more houses, more lumber, more fuel? The answer is yes. And we should care a lot. Our very existence has always, always depended on biodiversity. It does. It has in the past, and it always will. And right now, we humans are changing that biodiversity on a global scale at an alarming rate. Our population right now is about 6 billion, and it's projected to reach 10 billion by the year 2050. That's not very far away. My kids will be in their 40s at that time, and most of us will still be around. Right now, we're experiencing a mass extinction at the rate of 2 species lost per hour worldwide, and that's higher than the rate of the last mass extinction, which was the end of the dinosaurs. Extinction is natural, yes, we all know that, but our impact has elevated the rate of extinction by at least 1,000 times that rate, and we're part of the equation, so we can't separate ourselves out of it. So how can we differentiate between what would have happened naturally and what is human-caused right now? Mass extinctions like this have only occurred 5 times in the history of the planet. So I guess the main point of argument is how much time and energy and money is worth putting into saving species from extinction at the expense of cheap fuel, development, making a living. Overall, the major issues for biodiversity is how its conservation can be integrated with the other needs of our society. Our well-being and our environment include diversity of animals and plants, and they're completely interrelated. And right now, through pollution, thoughtless habitat destruction, intentional tampering with the natural balance, like introducing non-native species, it's changing the whole globe, even changing the climate. 2/3 of all the world's plant and animal species live only in the tropics. Loss of the tropical rainforest is the leading cause of species to become extinct globally. 40% of all the prescriptions written in the U.S. contain at least one ingredient originally made from a plant in these areas. This is a huge, huge subject, and we could debate all day, but we're going to cover 3 areas: medicinal value of keeping biodiversity, economic benefits, and importance of environmental niches. It's estimated that of the 35,000 different plant species in the tropics, 2/3 have medicinal value. And we're just now discovering potential cures from some amazing chemicals that life around us has. Becky's going to go into detail on that. On the subject of economic values, with all of our high technology, scientists are just now finding out about chemical secrets in new plants and animals, or new secrets, and that means benefits to human health. Okay. Victoria is going to go into the economic benefits of saving biodiversity. Third area of discussion is how different species act and react with each other in their environments, creating niches. They form and maintain communities, and we all depend on those interrelations for our survival. Mia's going to go into a discussion on how this affects us. Okay, later I'll now turn this over to Becky.
Actually, it's me. My name is Michelle, and my team, the Darwiners, is here today to argue against the prevention of species extinction. My teammates are Cindy, Mel, and Eric, and together we will be providing reasons why our actions in interfering with nature's course of species existence via such attempts as the Endangered Species Act has not only been unsuccessful, but actually harmful to humans, medically and economically, and as well has not posed any ecological importance to us at all. Biodiversity can be interpreted in many different ways, depending on your position. We feel that biodiversity is not only a measure of the variety of life, but the variety of habitat, the number of individuals of each species present, and the genetic diversity and variability within a population. Biodiversity was born through biological evolution, which is the process of change by which new species are developed from pre-existing species over time. As Darwin would say, it's the descent with modification. With this development of new species, it is inevitable that they will be in competition with like species for natural resources such as food and habitat. Thus, it becomes survival of the fittest. With this competitive interaction among species, extinction is inevitable. Population density fluctuations and extinction have occurred throughout the history of life on our planet, and together they are an important part of the natural cycle of life. The current diversity of species is a product of the processes of extinction and speciation throughout the hundreds and millions of years of history of life on this planet. One can say that human impact has elevated this rate of extinction by at least 1,000 times, but they would be wrong due to the fact that it has been found that through species-species interaction, species are actually driving others to extinction, species that we are actually trying to save under the Endangered Species Act. An example of this is in the northern spotted owl, which has become one of the most intensely studied species in the world. It was labeled as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, but it wasn't because we were disrupting its habitat. It's because it was in competition with the barred owl, which was pushing the spotted owl out of its habitat. As one can see, protecting these species can be as delicate and complicated as a spider's web. Aside from species extinction being a part of life, it has also been shown that some species have no benefit to human life and are in fact harmful at that. Cindy will be going into more detail, but to emphasize her arguments, it has been found that an increase in the number of species there has been also coincides with an increase in the number of hosts a disease or virus can live and thrive in. It's been shown that in the past about half of the human pathogens and diseases come from animals, but today it's shown that 3/4 of new diseases are zoonotic in origin, meaning that they're coming from animals. Furthermore, Mel, he will be discussing how we should be emphasizing more on our human population growth and concentrate on expanding the use of our land to feed our growing nation versus halting farming production to save an endangered species which may nest on potential farming grounds. This problem is extreme in consideration with private landowners who are virtually losing all of their land use rights to their properties when an endangered species is claimed to live on their land. An incident happened in Klamath River Basin of Southern Oregon in Northern California where 1,400 farmers owning 200,000 acres of land were denied water rights in 2001 due to the Endangered Species Act, which was emphasizing the conservation of species. Lastly, Eric will be arguing how nature is a balancing act in itself and that ecosystems will continue to exist with or without certain species. Our environment is capable of adapting to changes and life species alongside adapt to these changes as well. To sum it up, nature will continue to run its course with or without our intervention. So let's begin our debate.
Okay, my name is Rebecca with the Tree Huggers. I'm also known as Becky, and I'm going to start out with a definition of biodiversity and what it encompasses. Biodiversity is often defined as the variety of all forms of life, from genes to species through to the broad scale of ecosystems. Biodiversity was first coined as a contraction of the two terms biological diversity in 1985, but the new term arguably has a meaning and importance all of its own. Biodiversity encompassing genetic diversity, species, populations, communities, and ecosystems provides countless benefits to humans at all these levels. Some of these benefits include economic benefits, both direct and indirect, which Victoria will be talking about later, aesthetic benefits, which Mia will kind of touch on later also, and scientific and ethical knowledge and insurance for the future. With there being so many reasons why we should try to preserve biodiversity of the planet, I'm going to try to focus on the importance of the biodiversity to medicine and human health. Unfortunately, in the society we live in today, action is only taken if it has value or importance to the human individual. Everyone really wants to know what's in it for me. So I'm going to tell you why conserving biodiversity is of the utmost importance to you and your health. Why should you care? The implications of biodiversity loss for the global environment has been widely discussed, but only recently has attention been paid to its direct and serious effects on human health. Biodiversity loss affects the spread of human diseases, the causes of loss to medical models, diminishes the supplies of raw materials for drug discovery and biotechnology. Extinction isn't just a loss for science, it's a loss for us. We depend on biodiversity in our everyday lives to supply us with a healthy environment, which again Mia will talk about, and economically important products, which Victoria again will discuss later. When asked how many species humans routinely use in their daily lives, most people think it's usually just 1 to 200, but the correct answer is at least 40,000. Globally, each day, we depend on over 40,000 species of plants, animals, fungi, and microbes. Just as most of us don't know how our telephones or our TV sets or computers work, we really only have the vaguest idea of where our medicines come from. The medicines in our pharmacy are a compelling example. For thousands of years, people have derived medicines and cures from plants and animals. The most sophisticated research and development efforts of the world's biggest pharmaceutical companies rely on the genetic diversity of wild species. One statistic that I'd like to share is that 79% of the 150 most prescribed drugs have their origins in biodiversity. Worldwide, 119 different chemicals extracted from 90 species of higher plant life are used in manufacturing of pharmaceuticals. And in fact, 80% of the world's population relies on traditional plant and animal-derived medicines for their primary source of health care. A good example of this is the drug Taxol, which is now an important part of the chemical arsenal used to combat ovarian cancer, which was recently developed from components of the bark of the Pacific yew tree. Until the discovery of Taxol's effectiveness, the Pacific yew was considered a weed tree of no value and was routinely destroyed. There is also another drug extracted from the seed pods of the sausage tree in Africa, a drug that was recently shown to be effective against skin cancer. Yet still, only 2% of the 250,000 plants have been scientifically described, have been yet screened for chemical compounds as a potential source of new medical treatments. The rosy periwinkle, which is an excellent example, is a flowering plant found in Madagascar. It is the source of the alkaloid chemicals vinblastine and vincristine that are used to treat Hodgkin's disease and acute lymphocytic leukemia, which are two highly fatal cancers. The survival rate of lymphocytic leukemia, which is the most common form of childhood leukemia, was only 4% prior to the discovery of the rosy periwinkle's medicinal qualities. Today, 73% of those diagnosed survive. Although pharmaceutical companies have attempted to replicate the periwinkle's anti-cancer alkaloid compounds, synthetic vincristine has been found to be only 20% as effective as that made with the natural ingredients derived from the periwinkles. Anti-cancer agents of some potency have so far been identified in one out of every 10 plant species globally. A much larger portion are used to manufacture drugs and other nature-based health products or provide a source of important scientific information. The anti-cancer drugs developed from the rosy periwinkle alone have saved thousands of lives and are the basis of a $100 million industry. Yet Madagascar's other five species of periwinkles have never been adequately screened for their potential use. Drugs cannot be synthetically, aren't always able to be synthetically produced, and if they are, they're not always as effective as if the natural ingredient.
My name is Cindy, and I'm with the Darwiners, and I will be rebutting Becky's argument. It was actually once true that certain natural occurring compounds were too large and too complicated and could not be duplicated in the lab, but this is no longer true. In fact, in regards to digitoxin, which Becky actually left out of her argument because she ran out of time, it is actually beneficial to use the lab synthesized version. To provide you with a little background in organic chemistry, many chemical compounds have stereoisomers, which is basically the same compounds. Their connectivities, arrangement of the atoms are the same, they have the same molecular formula, everything is the same, but their arrangement and orientation in space is different. This small difference in the compound is can drastically change the nature of the compound. It is common to have one form of the stereoisomer to be beneficial and the other form to be actually very dangerous and poisonous and could actually kill you. And this is the case with the naturally occurring digitoxins. Most patients, it's actually used to treat heart disease, and most patients, in order to receive enough digitoxins to achieve therapeutic or the desired result, will also have to take in 60% of the toxic dose, and which is really, really bad. And this is a huge, huge problem. Because actually, it used to be responsible for one half of all drugs-induced deaths in hospitals. But nowadays, we are able to use stereoselective synthesis of digitoxins to produce only the desired stereoisomers for a medicinal purpose. Therefore, we no longer require the digitalis plants for the purpose of medicine, and it is not a valid argument to say that we need certain plants to produce medicines when we can produce superior products in the lab. And in response to the fact that a lot of medicines, we get our ideas and stuff looking for nature, it's we still have those. We don't need a lot of it. We can still work with what we got, and just because they're dying doesn't mean we're losing out of it. And this is Cindy again, and I'm going to present my side of the argument regarding the effect that biodiversity have upon human health. I will talk about the different diseases that animals transmit to humans, how increasing the number of species can actually increase disease, and the cost and consequences that these diseases have on the global community. Diseases that are passed on to humans by animals are called zoonotic diseases, and it is shown that half of all diseases in humans originally came from animals. But now, the new diseases are actually 3/4 can be traced back to animals. Some diseases that we have acquired from animals include measles, the West Nile virus, smallpox, influenza, monkeypox, SARS, the avian flu, and the Ebola virus, which is a contagious and incurable disease that makes a victim bleed to death. And the death rate for that disease is like 90% or something. It's extremely high. We also have the Nipah and encephalitis disease that emerged from Malaysia in the last 5 years, and BSV, which is really popular because it's the bovine spongiform encephalopathy, which is mad cow disease. And in 1918 to 1919, 3 flu pandemics killed between 20 and 50 million people, and it was regarded as the most deadly pandemic in human history. And as we all know, there has been a recent avian flu scare, and before that, a SARS scare. Estimate of the global cost of SARS range from a conservative $3 billion to a staggering $150 billion by some economists. And back to the avian flu, an outbreak in Pennsylvania of avian flu from 1983 to 1984 resulted in killing 17 million birds and costing $65 million. One reason why diseases that come from animals are so scary is that animals can be infected with multiple diseases from the other animals that are around it. Once in the animal, that animal acts as a mixing vessel and the different viruses can swap genetic material, creating new and more deadly viruses. This causes major shift in genetics and have the potential to cause pandemics. More species also means more hosts for a particular virus pathogen to live in and reproduce and then spread on to more animals and then eventually to humans. Many diseases come from animals living in close contact with one another. Smallpox, for example, is an extremely rare disease that is native to monkeys and squirrels of Africa, but somehow it found its way to America. So how did this disease find its way to America? The virus was passed on to rats, which then infected the prairie dogs, which were sold as pets in North America, which then in turn infected any person that comes into close contact with the prairie dog. Along this infectious path, this virus was able to mutate and infect different species. This shows that many species living in close contact with one another can increase the rate of transmission. There has also been a study that shows a correlation between the number of hosts and the severity of disease. So actually, the more hosts that a disease or a virus can infect, the more chance it has to mutate and change and actually will increase the severity of disease to make the disease more deadly and stuff like that. And therefore, not only does increase of number of species increase the number of diseases, it also increases the severity, making it more deadly. So therefore, animals harm humans by giving them more diseases, and it costs a lot of money. Billions and billions of dollars are spent trying to prevent diseases that come from animals, trying to stop disease, trying to clean up the mess that they made. And that's it. And I turn debate to...
This is Rebecca with the Tree Huggers again, and now I'm going to rebut Cindy's argument. It's true that there are diseases that are a part of nature, but this also, having a biodiversity also enables them to have more genetic pool to fight those diseases on their own by creating their own mutations to fight those own diseases. And then a larger exposure ratio to these animals also makes us naturally have a larger resistance over time. And then also the loss of the biodiversity puts those animals with the diseases closer to the humans because there's no other place for them to go. Also, I kind of want to touch back on the synthetics aren't as good for, as effective as natural is, because you can make a synthetic, but it usually the origin comes from the plant in nature. So scientists don't have to think of it. They just get it from nature and then they can replicate it. And if they didn't have anything like a pattern or a model to go off of, it would be really time expensive and really time consuming to try to make it up from scratch. Like as Cindy said, the digitoxin, that was actually taken from the plant that's called, commonly known as the foxglove. And if that blueprint wasn't there, then it wouldn't be able to be synthetically made in the first place. And we would still be trying to work it out. And then also, a scientist with the National Cancer Institute even acknowledged that the anti-cancer drug that I spoke about, Taxol, is just too complicated chemical structure for researchers to have invented on their own. So it just makes more sense for us to preserve the biodiversity we have, since once a species is gone, it's gone forever. Now it's Victoria who's going to talk about the economic benefits of biodiversity.
Hi, my name is Victoria, and I'm going to cover the economic benefits of biodiversity. The notion that biodiversity has provided us with many benefits is well understood. Some of these benefits come in the form of goods that can be directly valued and costed because they provide something that can be extracted and sold. These goods include everything from all the domesticated agricultural crops that form the base of the world's food supply, to medicines that protect and cure us that Becky just mentioned, to the fibers that make up the clothes we wear. Some of these supplies include crops, livestock, forestry, fish, medicines such as digitalis from the foxglove plant, which is used to treat heart troubles, morphine from the poppy plant used for pain relief, anti-cancer drugs that can come from tropical rainforests, For industry, there's fibers, clothing, wood, shelter, and warmth. And for tourism and recreation, there's parks and forests. Biodiversity also provides critical indirect benefits to humans that are difficult to quantify because we have never had to put a price tag on them. These benefits encompass ecosystem services such as air and water purification, climate regulation, and the generation of moisture and oxygen. A group of ecologists who recently attempted to quantify the price of replacing these ecosystem services calculated that they would cost over $3 trillion. That's greater than the entire global GNP. In other words, the world cannot afford to replace these services, therefore we must work to protect our ecosystems. Natural communities maintain proper gaseous concentrations in the atmosphere and prevent rapid climate changes. Drastic changes in the Earth's atmosphere can have catastrophic effects. Such changes are believed to have led to the disappearance of dinosaurs from Earth 65 million years ago. Much less drastic changes resulted in several global ice ages, the last of which ended 10,000 years ago. Some examples of these drastic changes include Hurricane Katrina, which hit New Orleans, and the tsunami in Southeast Asia. Vegetation helps recycle moisture in the atmosphere. A single corn plant, 1 pound dry weight, can transfer 60 gallons of water from soil to atmosphere in a few months. A single rainforest tree, in its 100-year lifespan, can transfer approximately 2.5 million gallons from soil to earth. Their role in the hydrologic cycle is crucial. A multiplicity of organisms is required to create soils and maintain fertility through complex cycles and interactions. Plant roots break up rock to create soil particles. Small animals like earthworms, mites, insects, and millipedes help give soil its texture and fertility and are crucial to its aeration. Even tinier soil microorganisms and fungi are responsible for cycling essential nutrients like nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur and making them available to higher plants. And their numbers are staggering. A gram of fertile agricultural soil may contain 2.5 billion bacteria, 400,000 fungi, 50,000 algae, and 30,000 protozoa. All these organisms have particular functions and interact with each other and with their physical environment to create the fertile soil that humans depend on for agricultural production. Natural ecosystems also help absorb the waste we create and render them non-toxic. Wetlands are large filters which purify fresh water and remove heavy metals and other contaminants from it. We often depend on rivers to flush away and break down the sewage and effluents that we put into them, which again depends on the array of small and large organisms that decompose and transform wastes in water. Soil organisms can slowly decompose food items, paper products, and other wastes produced by human activities. Economic arguments for protecting biodiversity are criticized for being too utilitarian and human-centered. Indeed, an excessive emphasis on the economic values of different species is seen as dangerous for two reasons. There's a bias towards the protection of species and ecosystems that have attributable economic value, and this perspective may also lead to the conclusion that ecosystems that are not directly benefiting humans are worth more to humans developed than undeveloped. In conclusion, the majority of species have yet to be evaluated for their current or future economic importance. Now we're going to turn to Mel, who's going to rebuttal.
Hi, my name is Mel from the Darwiners, and this is me rebuttaling Victoria. And I just want to ask a couple questions, Victoria. First question, you said there's a cost of not preserving biodiversity. What would that cost be?
Well, there are signs that saving habitats can support rather than weaken the economy. So, for example, a survey by the Institute for Economic Botany of New York Botanical Garden found that a forest in Belize is worth more to the economy standing than logged. And The latest statistics show that a plot of rainforest land converted to cattle operation yields the landowner $60 per acre, and if timber is harvested, the land is worth $400 per acre.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to get that cleared up. And you also mentioned earlier that Hurricane Katrina and the dinosaurs is due to like a change in biodiversity. Well, for one, the dinosaurs becoming extinct, that was way before human beings came into picture. So like that should show you that nature does its own thing. Like it's not up to humans to decide. Like that in itself is like showing that nature it has its own little cycle going, and species go extinct here and there. My partner here, Eric, will elaborate on that later. And Hurricane Katrina, which you mentioned earlier, equal amount of studies have shown that, you know, to correlates with that belief that the Earth is just going through a cycle. We've gone through several ice ages, and now we're going through a couple of things which the Earth needs to do to come back to equilibrium. I want to go back to your goods being produced through biodiversity. Yeah, that's true, but like my partner here, Cindy, also elaborated, it's a lot of things are being synthetically made now. Okay, yeah. A lot of things are synthetically made nowadays with the information that we've already gathered right now. And with, 2.5 billion bacteria already in the world, you know, we could lose a couple million, you know? It's okay. We'll find something else to replace that 1 million, find a couple chemicals and compounds, and, you know, okay, there goes my rebuttal. And this is Mel again. And let's see. This is my economic, I'm doing economics for the Darwiner. And here we go. So like those who support biodiversity, they like to enjoy to paint this image of death and reckless abandon by the hands of conglomerate powers that be. For every luxury we hold, another animal must die. For every animal on the chopping block, it's another dollar in the pockets of the money mongers. You know, the truth is, the use of land is an essential skill of human beings that human beings have been entrusted. It has been the essence of our survival, and to master the land is the very reason why we're walking here today. Come on, it's not 1900 anymore. We're no longer part of small cluster of towns that have flowering relationships with the environment, nor are we tribal where we can depend on this delicate balance with our surroundings. You know, ever since the Industrial Revolution, there has been this huge population explosion. And as common knowledge has it, the human population doubles every couple of decades. And as we double, our population's needs do. It's like their needs for water, shelter, food, and space, all of which conflict with the interests of animals and that are in the way of our, like, basic practices, like farming practices and methods. So, according to the Census Bureau, the United States has approximately 290 to 295 million people living within its borders. California alone contributes approximately 35 million people to that number. These people can't feed themselves on ideals, and that's what biodiversity is. It's an ideal. It's this whole ideal way of living on Earth. It takes an efficient system and a large system to feed that many people. Furthermore, it's expected by 2020 up to 70% of the world population will be living in urban areas as opposed to 30%. And one of the proponents of biodiversity is actually against something that could help alleviate some of this problem of agriculture, and that's genetically modifying food. I'm not going to go into the specifics of genetically modifying food, but it does help put resistance on pesticides, and it does help farmers to yield higher crops. So, you know, it lowers the cost of providing these produce, and raising the amount getting out there to the consumers, which you know, will save millions and millions of dollars in, you know, pesticides alone. It will save a lot of money. Outside of America, nations such as Afghanistan, Central African Republic, and Ecuador are known for deforestation in their slash and burn farming methods. These practices are known to potentially destroy thousands of species, some which may have never been recorded. And, you know, although it is a dated practice, it's a means to help support their people. And until economics allows for, like, a more level playing ground for all nations, it's just something that they have to do. Simply a card that's dealt to them. You know, if it was between me and an evolving pig, then, like, give me some French toast with that bacon. Come on. So Another aspect of trying to preserve biodiversity is that it has economic ramifications. The preservation of endangered species is an extremely costly process. The techniques include extensive research, a plan of introducing multiple factors into the environment, and a method of tracking progress. And it costs a lot of money. For example, 1989 to 1991, it cost $33.3 million to help reinstate the bald eagle, to help the bald eagle get away from the endangered species list. And furthermore, this process doesn't even have an efficient record of success. The National Government Association, NGA, recorded 2004 out of nearly 1,300 species protected under list, only 11 have recovered successfully. That's like a 0.01% success record. That's pretty bad, especially considering how much money we're putting into this. A more specific example is in America, the Klamath River had a species of crayfish that was considered endangered. To save this fading species, a decision was made that the river had to be raised. Yet later research found that the science that this decision was based upon was faulty. So it was an isolated incident. According to Dr. Michael Kaufman, there was a huge misuse of science that led to that decision. So it's bad information being brought upon by bad science that leads to bad ideas that allows billions of dollars to be pumped into a system that cannot even identify the problem they are trying to solve. Now, I'm not saying let's kill all the animals, no. But come on, ideals need solid foundation. And in this case, solid scientific, it doesn't have science, solid foundation. All right, time's up.
Cool.
Yeah.
Time's
up. Break me apart.
This is Victoria again. I would like to rebuttal with Mel. I would like to restate my answer to your question earlier about how much it's going to cost. I told you about how it's going to cost $60 per acre if the timber is harvested and if the land is worth $400 per acre. But however, if renewable and sustainable resources are harvested, the land will yield the landowner $2,400 per acre. That's it.
We're going to take a break for 1 minute, a 1 minute break.
Time out for 1 minute? Okay.
Oh,
shoot,
I don't need that.
Still going?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
just so
we never stop.
Oh, okay.
Just
say it now.
We're back. Our biodiversity is priceless.
That's all I had to say.
Okay. That was a really weak break.
Okay.
Give me 5 minutes.
Hey, my name is Mia, and I'm with the biodiversity group, and I'm doing environmental niches and variety of life. I have three topics to talk about today. I have habitat, predators, and overexploited resources. So as my captain already explained, biodiversity, again, is the difference of variety of living species on Earth. So that being said, we need to concern ourselves with the three areas, habitat, predators, and overexploited resources. Habitat first is a big topic today. 2% of our area's rainforest each year will be destroyed, and that affects our small population, which then in turn can affect, it's been shown to affect the sex ratio in populations, and if this is done, then you have a difference between male and female populations, and if that occurs, then the reproduction is affected, and thus the species will die out. A predator example of predators being affected in Australia. One thing you don't want to do when you're dealing with biodiversity is you don't want to mix the environmental niches, because one thing that can be caused by doing so, example in Australia being where the marsupials are found naturally prevalent, is they introduced mammals into Australia when trade became used via ship, steamships. So they introduced mammals, and what happened was the mammals, dogs especially, started taking over the marsupial population and ended up killing that out. So that is not what we're looking for with biodiversity. It's not to intermove habitats from one into another. That will not cure the issue. And then finally, my larger argument is overexploited our resources. We have, protecting our resources goes hand in hand with biodiversity. A species like humans will completely die out by exhausting one resource. They all are equally important, and all balls need to be juggled and caught in order to maintain our careful balance here. And America, being the superpower that it is, has so many resources. For 350 million people, we have the world's largest resources compared to a nation like China, which is 1 billion, excuse me, or then there's India, which is 1 billion. Their resources don't come close to America's resources, so we should be very proud of our resources that we have here. Being what we have, we have plants, that, and let's just stay local here because we're all native Californians, well, at least now, currently. California Forensic Province, as it's the hotspot is considered, or this niche that we're living in is considered, is distinguished by this endemism of its plants and its animals. Over 3,500 species of vascular plants in this hotspot, more than 2,120 are found nowhere else in the world. This high level of endemic species in California is because of the resources found here. The giant sequoia is one amazing animal that I'd like to talk about, or I'm sorry, plant, which remains in 75 groves in the Sierra Nevada range, is the most massive species ever to live on Earth, reaching heights of 75 meters and circumference of 30 meters in this oldest tree. We've got birds, mammals. The condors is an example of the bird, although there are only 25 to 35 condors remaining. The population is now reaching over 100, where, like I said, in 1970 it was 25 to 35. The amphibian levels are wonderful also in California, and so are the invertebrates. And one thing we're doing, we have our natural parks. You have to give me time, I don't know if that means. Our natural parks, are also a way that we show how much we respect our resources. So we have more resources than anyone else. We have 37%, actually, to be exact, and we need to protect that. Charles Darwin said it best, survival of the fittest, not survival of the greedy. The more powerful the species as humans are, the more responsible we should be. If we are responsible, we respect and take care of our resources so we can survive as a species. By having biodiversity, we can more monitor all the resources. In order to monitor, we need to have this diversity. And monitoring is a way to tell what is going to take effect on us. And in the end of the day, it's our hide that matters. And in order to save ourselves, we have to save everyone else, because they're the factor. When they start to get affected, that's the red flag that goes up that lets us know that we too are being affected, or eventually will be. Lastly, if we want to have freedom to reproduce as we will, unlike China with their one-child policy, or live where we want and be mandated to not be mandated to stay in specific areas, we need to protect these so that we can have the luxuries of our democracy that we love so much. Then we must take the resources and preserve them so that we're here to enjoy them and we can keep this on for our children. And the biological monitoring of these resources allowed by biodiversity is the only way to prevent human species from going out and them too being a factor of extinction.
There you go. Hello, I'm Eric from the Darwinners. Mia and the Tree Huggers would have you believe that disruptions in the environment will cause changes that can't be recovered. Life and evolution is based on these changes. I'd like to give you an example of the eagles and the DDT. According to Dr. J. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist at San Jose State University, who testified in 1971 through 72 for the Environmental Protection Agency hearings on DDT, he proved that since DDT wasn't manufactured anywhere before 1943, it was not used in North America until 1945, yet the bald eagles were threatened with extinction in the lower 48 U.S. states as early as the 1920s. There were no bald eagles in New England in 1937. Even after 15 years of heavy agricultural use of DDT in the U.S., the Audubon Society, which is a society that watches birds and their numbers, counted 25% more eagles per observer in 1960 than in the pre-DDT era in 1941. The administrative law judge who conducted the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's DDT hearings recommended in 1972 that it should not be banned because studies failed to show that it thinned the eagles' eggshells. Eagle populations are now thriving, and it just shows that population density fluctuations are just a natural part of our ecosystem. Also, it's a very consistent finding that there's a 3-4 prey to predator ratio, but this is not based on taxonomic classifications, as in like what species, but it's based on types of animals or kinds. One species can be more than one kind of predator, and multiple species can fall into the same category as the same kind of predator or prey. From this model, you can see that it's easy that one species can fill the space of another. And last of all, Mia, you stated that we should be proud of our resources that we have. What good are resources if we don't use them? And for my side of the argument, I'm here to explain to you that increasing biodiversity is not necessary to maintain healthy ecosystems. In many cases, when we tamper with the environment with the intention to help, we just further damage it, the natural cycle that systems go through. As we all know, major extinctions have happened several times throughout Earth's history, and each time, genetic diversity has increased to fill the ecosystem's niches. Natural systems lose species through emigration, epidemics, increased vulnerability to predators, natural catastrophes, and many other factors. It's just a normal part of what's happened since we've had life on our Earth. A system is said to be species deletion stable if, following the removal of that species from the system, all of the remaining species are retained at a new local stable equilibrium. In the case of species that are close to extinction, if there's not, as in, like, there's not a lot of abundance of their kind, their ecosystem are very stable if we delete them, because they're, if we delete a species that is high in abundance or has high connectance with another species, then the system is not species deletion stable. But when the species we choose to extinct are low in number, then there's obviously a low connectance between other species, and there's not a high abundance. It's just not going to have a large effect on the ecosystem. By protecting these species, are we really helping them in the long run? Basically, if we take a species that has low numbers and little genetic diversity and we raise them to a high number, then we just have a lot of animals that are still not genetically diverse and still not adapted to their environment. On a study of bird fragmentation by Diamond, 1984, in Brazilian rainforests, it shows that when we split from farming, when we split the rainforest in different pieces, then the endemic birds, they stay endemic, and the only birds that go extinct, that go locally extinct, are the ones that were rare there to begin with. This shows the balance of nature. Ecosystems have always worked on balance and will continue this. Because animals rely off each other, the balance of an ecosystem will change when species change, but it will continue to work like it always does. According to Stuart L. Pym, in his book in 2002 called Food Webs, most studies focus on one species. When the interactions between two or more populations, by using a little common sense and observation, we know that healthy systems have high resiliency, which means that they can resist change very well. Protecting biodiversity just for the sake of protecting biodiversity has gotten way out of hand. In the case of fairy shrimp, a small organism that lives in the ground and in parts of Northern California, has caused delay and disruption for many years on businesses that want to build, they want to start their business on that land, which will help the area's economy. And this still leaves room for the organisms after construction. How far are we going to go? Parasites, diseases from bacteria, they're all part of nature, but I don't think that anyone is going to say that we should protect their biodiversity. It's going too far, and it needs to slow down.
This is Mia again with a rebuttal to Eric. The reason why biodiversity is important, it's not to protect it for the sake of protecting it, it's to protect it because it in return ensures our own existence. By losing one resource, as I previously said, we risk our own future. And what you said about the species dying out, the bird population, if it's because it was rare, that's why it died out. Rare isn't a reason for it to die out. It should be more protected if it's rare. And who knows the benefits that that population can add to the ecosystem it's living in. And so we shouldn't say because it's small and minute in numbers or rare that it's not a cause for concern. A reason why I think humans need to be concerned with biodiversity also is because who wants to sit around and wait for us to die out? These extinction factors that you're talking about, we're in the highest level of extinction yet to come. It's the 99% of all species ever to be on Earth are now extinct, and that's the highest it's ever been, and who's to say we too aren't on that list of extinction? That is why biodiversity is so important, and that's why we need to protect it not only for ourselves but for our future and our future children.
I'm Kathy, and I'm going to respond to a few of the points and conclude this. One thing I want to address is with the mass extinctions that we're having, it's been pretty much found by scientific evidence that the dinosaurs' extinction was because of a meteorite or a meteor hitting the Earth and changing the whole climate of the Earth. Well, you know, nothing like that is happening right now. What's happening is we are polluting our Earth, and we're contributing to the CO2, we're raising the carbon dioxide levels. We are, without any kind of catastrophic event, causing the biggest mass extinction ever. Okay? And that's by our human events. In response to Eric's comment on protecting biodiversity for the sake of protecting biodiversity, I'm going to expand on what Mia said, that the best argument really for preserving it is not for the sake of itself, but it's to maintain the links so that when those links lead to humans, we aren't adversely affected. Because of the interrelationships among all the different species on Earth, the collapse of any ecosystem is going to diminish the quality of our life. You know, of human life. One single species, like the spotted owl, may not seem worth saving, but it might be only a few links away from one that is, or it might be a signal that a vital ecosystem is disappearing. And the case with the spotted owl is that old growth forest is disappearing, and old growth forest not only supports the spotted owl, but it supports fungi, it supports animals, plants, it supports us, and it might support the next cure for cancer. We still don't have a cure for cancer. We're searching the oceans, we're searching the tropical plants, and right now we're doing and finding some really promising chemicals from the coral reefs and the sponges, and those are some of the most delicate systems on Earth. Basically, you touch a coral with your finger and it dies. So these animals have had millions and millions of years to evolve various poisons and chemicals that we can't even begin to dream up in a lab, let alone, you know, make ourselves. And if those are gone, then our hopes for finding cures for these diseases are going to be gone. So in the words of Lynn Caprell, who is a famous author and researcher in molecular biology, she says, "The loss of the biological diversity is the loss of a library that contains answers to questions that we haven't even learned how to ask yet." Every day, new research reveals the critical role played by some seemingly little unimportant life form. And right now, we don't even know which species are pivotal or keystone and which aren't. So if we start wiping out species, we have no idea. How's time looking? Okay? And then there's a domino effect. We take one species out of the ecosystem, and the whole ecosystem can collapse. A classic example was Yellowstone. The ecosystem was in trouble. Elk were eating everything. It was out of control.
You're done?
Okay. Yes, I'm done. Yeah. And it's on to Michelle for the final.
All right. So, in conclusion, as we have observed 5 times throughout the history of our planet, recovery from extinction has been successful on a geological timescale, and each mass extinction has been followed by a sudden burst of evolutionary diversification on the part of the remaining species, which this is to be suspected because the surviving species started using habitats and resources that were previously occupied by more competitively successful species that went extinct. The current loss of biodiversity not only stems from nature's pathway of life, but also from species-species competitive interactions that occur within. Our environment cannot sustain life for all like species, so extinction is therefore fate for the unfit. No species on our planet would put the interest of another species before its own, so why should human beings? Keystone species are only key in keeping that ecosystem working as it is at that time. Without that keystone species, the ecosystem will survive, but in a different food web. Genetic diversity will increase to keep natural balance of a 3-to-4 ratio, prey-predator ratio. And in regards to medicine, modern science has advanced to the point where inspiration from nature is no longer needed. Today, medicines derived from natural products are in the minority. In any case, the upcoming era of genetic engineering will allow mankind to rid himself of disease without resorting to medicines. And on top of that, some species are even harmful to humans, as more and more of them are hosting deadly viruses and diseases. In the course of over 30 years, we've been trying to conserve species and maintain a diversified biological structure of species. But after 3 decades and $1 billion of spending, only 15 species out of 1,853 species listed as endangered or threatened have actually been recovered. Obviously, our intervention and attempts to preserve species has not been successful. Species will continue to die out, and speciation will bring in new species, and there's no way to control nature. These changes happen for environmental reasons beyond our control. Our planet will adapt to these changes and continue to maintain existence as it has been for the past hundreds and millions of years of life on this planet. And who is to say that human beings will live forever? If nature runs its course and we die out, no doubt speciation will occur and a new species will develop, like us, but modified. So life will continue to go on, no matter if we exist or not. And I conclude with that.
We have some audience members today. You guys want to say hi?
Hi.
Okay. Science your favorite subject?
No.
Yeah.
Yay, good answer.
Okay, thanks, Tony.